The United States of America didn't establish a lasting central bank until December of 1913. A financial panic, recession, and robber baron lender of last resort rescue finally pushed the country to establish the Federal Reserve System. But the 1913 version was not the country's first attempt at a central bank.
Ladies and gentlemen, you could have been anywhere.
We're going to look back at two early attempts at a United States central bank.
The issue on the table. Secretary Hamilton's plan to assume state debt and establish a national bank. Secretary Jefferson, you have the floor, sir.
History and Broadway spoiler alert. In one of the earliest and most famous founding compromises, Alexander Hamilton agreed to move the fledgling nation's capital to the banks of the Potomac River in the northeast corner of Virginia. In exchange, Thomas Jefferson agreed to the formation of the first bank of the United States. The charter for the new bank was based off of the original Bank of England charter. Welcome to the Bankster Podcast from centralverse.org. This is Season 3, Last Resort, and I'm your host, Alexander Badgett. Today, Episode 2, J.P. Morgan and Friends. The first episode, outlining the early central banks of Amsterdam, Sweden, and England, concluded with the publication of Walter Badgett's famous book, Lombard Street, The Modern Central Banker's Bible. Although taken slightly out of context and not written in these exact words, practitioners today quote the lesson from Badgett's book as follows. When there's a crisis, the central bank should 1. Lend freely, 2. On good collateral, and 3. At a penalty rate. In other words, the role of the central bank is to be the lender of last resort. The founding of Hamilton's National Bank was a big step. The first bank of the U.S. would issue national currency, be the bank for the federal government, and, quote, provide a safe place to keep public funds, close quote. Unfortunately, the charter had a 20-year expiration date. And in 1811, when the 20 years were up, the bill that would have extended the life of the country's central bank was rejected in the House of Representatives by one vote, and the tie-breaking vote in the Senate was cast in opposition by the vice president of James Madison. Thus ended the First Bank of the United States. But as a documentary about the First Bank of the U.S. concludes,
no more national bank, at least for a little while.
War was on the horizon.
In June 1812, the young United States declared war on the greatest power in the world, Great Britain. For 2.5 years, Americans fought against the British, Canadian colonists, and Native nations in a small but bitter war.
The War of 1812 sowed the seed that would start and bring to power the man that would end the United States' next attempt at a central bank.
The government simply did not have a way of financing the war in the fall of 1814. And one of the byproducts of that was that it defaulted on the national debt. Public credit had collapsed, and I think it's fair to say the U.S. government was on the verge of bankruptcy.
Because the First Bank of the United States had been shuttered, there was no longer an entity that could control the amount of money created. In addition, strong demand for loans during the war increased interest rates and thus bank profits. Without the restraining hand of the Bank of the United States, state banks became less cautious in their lending habits and credit expanded rapidly. In effect, the country found itself in circumstances similar to those after the Revolutionary War. Mounting debt from a war with England, soaring prices, and devalued money from rising inflation. The money situation got so bad that
the British took advantage of this by paying American farmers in hard money.
A tremendous amount of American produce and provisions was flowing into Canada and actually feeding the British army.
This led President Madison, in the spring of 1814, to begin to support the idea of founding a new version of the country's central bank. But it would take the end of the war and a broad economic downturn before, in April 1816, he signed legislation creating the Second Bank of the United States. Again, the central bank was given a 20-year charter, but this time, it almost didn't even make it the full 20. The man responsible?
The very great Andrew Jackson. I think a lot of people see Jackson on our currency and assume that he was a great president. He was an influential president, but that doesn't necessarily mean that he was great.
Andrew Jackson really rose to fame after his decisive victory against the British in the Battle of New Orleans during the War of 1812. During the following decade, Jackson's popularity grew, and in 1828 he defeated John Quincy Adams to become the 7th president of the United States. Jackson was known as, quote, a determined foe of banks in general and the Second Bank of the United States in particular, close quote. With a presidential veto, Jackson squashed Congress's attempt to get an early start to rechartering the Second Bank.
Jackson's vice president, Martin Van Buren, came into the White House and Jackson was lying on a daybed, groaning and moaning. Van Buren ran over to him and said, "What is it, Mr. President? What's the matter?" And Jackson said, "The bank, Mr. Van Buren, the bank is trying to kill me, but I will kill it."
Jackson's hatred for the Second Bank played a significant role in his reelection campaign in 1832, and he pressed hard over the next 4 years to follow through with his commitment to kill the central bank. Ultimately, his efforts were successful. The Second Bank of the United States expired without renewal in 1836 at the end of its 20-year charter, just like its predecessor, the First Bank. The next 70 years were quite traumatic for the United States. The nation split in two and fought a terrible and bloody civil war. Three presidents were assassinated, and the country experienced frequent, severe financial crises. Because the country lacked a central bank, a number of different systems cropped up to fulfill the market needs that are normally satisfied by a central bank. Clearing houses were set up so banks could gather once a day and settle their accounts all at once, instead of each bank having to make individual visits to all of the other banks every day. The clearing houses would also provide temporary assistance to member banks, acting like non-governmental lenders of last resort. Reserve cities like New York, Chicago, and St. Louis formed naturally where larger banks could provide services to smaller banks in the city and surrounding rural areas. And lastly, in the 1860s, the federal government passed a law creating a banking system that would permit national banks to issue currency that would be accepted throughout the entire country. Now, the sum of each of these individual fixes was less organized, less efficient, and allowed more serious and frequent financial crises than a federally chartered lender of last resort would have. As one historian of the era put it,
America had been scorched by 5 severe banking crises, in addition to more than 20 lesser panics, in little more than a generation.
By 1907, a national and even international financial system was beginning to form, but the system was still not equipped to handle a true panic, and a panic was coming. Now, no crisis is the fault of one person, and no successful rescue can be attributed to a single person. But the stories we tell have heroes and villains for a reason. Some people play an outsized role in bringing the system down, and others in pushing it back up. The October 1907 attempted corner of the copper market, the financial panic it caused, and the subsequent rescue have a handful of such heroes and villains. Let me introduce you to two of them. First up, one of the leading men responsible for the cause of the 1907 panic.
Pacific Northwest. Today we're talking about a character. This guy probably deserves a series unto himself, but he is legendary in this part of the country.
On both sides of the line, Mike, we're talking about Fritz Augustus Heinz. And Fritz Augustus Heinz, I guess, was one of the strangest guys who ever walked down the pike. He got his start at 19 years old.
Second, one of the leading men responsible for the rescue.
Into this era of opportunity, one powerful man emerged, a man who pulled the financial strings of wealthy men and entire countries, a man who brought order to chaos, J. Pierpont Morgan.
The strange man Hines, although from New York, made his fortune as one of the copper kings in the mining industry of rural Montana. After selling his land in Montana, Hines bought a significant stake in the Mercantile National Bank in Manhattan. He then made himself its president and joined the board of directors of a dozen other banks and trusts. Although initially hesitant, Hines was convinced by his brother to use funds from the Mercantile National Bank to make a financial gamble on the industry he had spent the previous decade working on, out in the West.
He invests in a very, very high-flying company called United Copper, but they'd set the trap.
The Hines brothers were able to convince a number of others to join them in financing the corner of the United Copper stock. One was a man named Charles Barney, the president of the Knickerbocker Trust Company, the third largest trust in New York City. Although their corner moved in the right direction for a few days, the gamble that they had secured a majority of the shares proved false when they unsuccessfully attempted to squeeze out the short sellers. Between Monday, October 14th and Wednesday, October 16th, 1907, the stock price came crashing down from over $60 a share to below $10 a share. A stunning defeat for the Hines brothers, Charles Barney, and those who had joined them. The United Copper Company wasn't listed on the New York Stock Exchange, so its shares were traded outside of the exchange, literally on the sidewalk outside of the Stock Exchange building. Regarding the failed corner, the Wall Street Journal reported,
"There is little doubt that this week's episode in United Copper shares on the New York curb will go into stock exchange history as one of the most absurd pieces of speculative jugglery ever attempted."
By Saturday, October 19th, the clearinghouse, and remember that clearinghouses are the partial lender of last resort entities to their member banks, announced that they would provide additional temporary rescue loans to Hines's bank, only on the condition that Hines and his entire board of directors resigned. That was the end of Hines's Wall Street career, but his failed stock market gamble was about to turn into one of the worst economic crises of U.S. history to that point. As many crises do, the Panic of 1907 quickly escalated from mild to severe, where the run and the panic spread from entities under the umbrella of the lender of last resort and infected entities outside the protection of the lender of last resort. See, trusts were like banks in many ways, but they were not banks, and therefore trusts were not members of the clearinghouses. That meant they didn't have access to the clearinghouse emergency loans and were subject to looser regulations. On Monday, October 21st, 1907, after the clearinghouse confirmed they would provide no rescue to the Knickerbocker Trust, the Knickerbocker Trust board of directors fired their president, Charles Barney, for his involvement with Hines in the failed United Copper Company stock market corner. As the panic began to unfold, J.P. Morgan was kept abreast of the situation by some of his assistants. Morgan himself had been in Richmond, Virginia, attending the Triennial Episcopal Convention. By Saturday, October 19th, he had been convinced that the situation was spiraling out of control to such a degree that his support was required. He took a private train back to New York. The Knickerbocker Trust reached out to Morgan for help, who quickly put together and sent a team of bankers to go and review the trust's books. On Tuesday, October 22nd, fearing that the Knickerbocker Trust would fail, a dramatic run began. Within a few hours of opening, the trust lost $8 million of its deposits. By early afternoon, the team that was reviewing the books reported back to Morgan that they couldn't confirm that the trust was fundamentally solvent. After Morgan announced that he would not intervene, the Knickerbocker Trust was forced to close their Fifth Avenue headquarters early. One historian put it this way.
In letting the Knickerbocker fail, Morgan knew he would be unleashing frantic runs on every other trust in the city. The resulting panic, as Schiff had predicted, made previous debacles look like child's play indeed.
Hearing of the panic spreading in New York, the U.S. Treasury Secretary made the trip up from Washington, D.C. When the Secretary arrived, a group of bankers gathered together with, as the New York Times reported, Mr. Morgan presiding. On Wednesday, October 23rd, the run spread to the second largest trust in New York, called the Trust of America. Again, within hours of opening, the trust found itself running extremely low of cash to satisfy the demand for deposit withdrawals. Also again, the trust reached out to Morgan for assistance. Mr. Morgan sent an associate to review their books. This time, however, the associate reported that although the trust had suffered a severe drop in surplus, overall, it was indeed solvent. Hearing this, Morgan reportedly said calmly,
"This, then, is the place to stop this trouble."
Morgan and the group of bankers he had met with the night before in the company of the Treasury Secretary put together an emergency loan conditioned on the Trust of America providing sufficient capital to back the loan. They did just that. The employees of the trust company brought boxes of loan documents to Morgan's offices. When the team had reviewed enough to be satisfied, they officially released the emergency funds. Although this allowed the trust to survive another day, by this time the panic and run had spread to the wider stock market. On Thursday, October 24th, the president of the stock exchange came to Morgan to warn him that unless they received near immediate assistance, they would have to shut the exchange down. Morgan passionately responded,
"It must not close 1 minute before that hour today," emphasizing each word by keeping time with his right hand, middle finger pointing directly at the president of the exchange. Morgan said he would take immediate steps to arrange a loan.
Again, Morgan called the heads of the largest New York banks to his office, this time to rescue not just a struggling institution, but the broader stock market.
When the bank presidents had finally gathered, Morgan explained the situation to them. He said simply that unless they raised $25 million within the next 10 to 12 minutes, at least 50 stock exchange houses would fail.
Literally within minutes, the bankers had pledged nearly $25 million. This pool of money served as the last resort loan that kept the securities market alive. The system had survived the battle, but the war was far from over. The following morning, Friday, October 25th, despite a somewhat calmer start, the day quickly took a dramatic negative turn. The struggling trust companies were calling in their loans to satisfy the demands for deposit withdrawal requests. This was sending a chill through the economy. See, this is why banking panics are so dangerous. The trusts were being forced to call in loans that they had extended in the past. Those loans had helped the economy grow. They may have allowed individuals to purchase homes or businesses to expand. When the trusts forced them to be paid back, it didn't mean that those loans were bad. To the contrary, most of those loans would have probably been paid back in full if given the time. But the traditional business of banks and trusts, like we learned last week in the It's a Wonderful Life movie, is to take lots of deposits and other short-term credit and then use 90% or so of it to extend long-term loans to people and businesses. That business model works and helps the economy tremendously. As long as depositors and short-term creditors don't all come asking for their money back all at once. When they do, the banks and trusts have to call in the loans they had extended. And quickly, all that economic growth that the loans were supporting is stopped and reversed. When a panic starts, people stop spending and businesses stop expanding. That is the chilling effect that banking panics can have on an economy. That's what was beginning to happen on Friday, October 25th, 1907. No one was closer to the panic than the president of the stock exchange, who was once again running to Morgan, requesting an additional loan. Morgan called the group of bankers back together again. Although gathered at the clearinghouse and aware of the impending danger, the bankers were not as willing as they had been the day before. Certainty about the usefulness of the funds was beginning to wane. The meeting ended with just $10 million secured. By the end of the trading day, it had become clear that although the $10 million had helped prevent a complete collapse of the financial system, it had not been enough to save all of the banks. An additional 7 banks failed that day. For the third time in little more than 24 hours, Morgan summoned the group of bankers, quote, acknowledging that he could not continue bailing out the banks and forming money pools to assist this exchange. Instead, they turned their attention toward reassuring the public, close quote. To do this, Morgan organized the group into 2 committees that would run 2 information campaigns, one targeting the press, The other, responsible for contacting every possible clergyman, priest, or rabbi in New York City. To both groups, the message was the same. Stay calm, act reasonably, and don't withdraw your money. Then, just as the bank run looked like it was abating, the city of New York ran into its own problems. They were running desperately short of cash, and the U.S. Secretary announced that their surplus had been exhausted and they wouldn't be able to help.
Now more than ever, Morgan became indispensable. He filled the vacuum of central banker like a Medici prince, holding council in the evenings in his library, which was studded with hanging tapestries, ancient Bibles, and rare medieval manuscripts.
One more time for this monumental economic crisis, Morgan stepped up, gathered the bankers together again, and pulled enough money together to provide an emergency loan sufficiently large enough to keep the city government afloat. Overall, what started as a relatively minor stock market gamble by a copper magnate and his friends turned into a widespread loss of confidence that sparked a run on the trust companies, which then spread to the banks. Now, the way to stop a bank run is to convince consumers, businesses, and banks alike to not hoard money. When everyone stops spending, everyone stops earning. People make rational decisions as individuals that are detrimental to the overall economy. Everybody wants the confidence of holding cash. The purpose of a central bank is to provide that liquidity when it's needed. That's what Badgett recommends. It's why the United Kingdom didn't have a single banking suspension while, as mentioned previously, America had been scorched by 5 severe banking crises in addition to more than 20 lesser panics in little more than a generation. As introduced, J.P. Morgan served as a type of economic hero of the day. He stepped into the role of central bank because the country lacked a formal lender of last resort. Here are a handful of comments regarding Morgan's actions. The New York Times front page of October 26, 1907, has 2 large print mentions of Morgan on the front page. One is a tribute to Morgan from London's great financier, Rothschild. Quote, "Mr. Morgan's latest action fills one with admiration and respect," close quote. So great was Morgan's role in the rescue that his second mention on the front page is a report about a potential cold that Morgan had contracted while staying out late organizing the bank rescues. One prominent New York lawyer declared, quote, "You stand between us and financial chaos," close quote. Another banker reported that, quote, "The safety and welfare of the financial structure of this country depends almost entirely upon you," close quote. A contemporary poem about Morgan was written and published in the paper the day after the report about his health. It went like this.
When banks and trusts go crashing down from credit's sullied name, while speechifying greatness adds more fuel to the flame, when Titan's strength is needed sore, black ruins tied to stem, who is the man who does the job? It's JPM.
6 years later, a few months before the Federal Reserve Act was signed into law, John Pierpont Morgan passed away.
Morgan's death provoked an extraordinary reaction for a private individual who had never held public office. Within 24 hours, over 5,000 telegrams poured into the hotel in Rome where he had died, including telegrams from the Pope and the Emperor of Germany and the King of England. And his body was brought back to New York, and there was a huge funeral at St. George's Church where he had faithfully attended for many, many years.
As clear as it had been that Morgan had been the deciding factor in the survival of the U.S. economy that fall in 1907, it was equally clear that this was not the ideal design of a financial system. The country needed a central bank. When the panic had ceased, one of the bankers that worked closely with Morgan during all of the rescues reached out to Paul Warburg, a German immigrant who had been pushing for the creation of a U.S. central bank. "It's too late," Warburg told him. Quote, "What has to be done cannot be done in a hurry. If reform is to be secured, it will take years of educational work to bring it about. Only a modern central bank can cure America's ills," close quote. And Warburg was correct. It would take a little over 6 years, many proposals, a change in the presidency, and a grand compromise. But eventually, the U.S. did in fact create a lasting central bank. the Federal Reserve System. The country had experienced a dramatic financial crisis, and someone had stepped in to provide the liquidity required to prevent the system from complete and utter collapse. But the next time it happened, the country wanted a central bank to be the one stepping in. They didn't want to depend on whoever happened to be the richest, most well-connected man in town. On the next episode, we'll flash forward to the greatest and darkest economic crisis of the 20th century, the Great Depression. How and why the Federal Reserve failed to act, how deposit insurance affects financial panics, and how a man from rural Utah redesigned the central bank's structure. Today's episode was written, edited, and produced by me, Alexander Badgett. Additional voice acting from Alejandra Nygaard and Joshi Nygaard. A full transcript with links to all of the sources used and quoted in today's episode can be found at www.centralverse.org. While you're there, make sure to check out the interactive graphics describing how modern central banks work today. There are two books that were especially helpful in researching and writing today's episodes. You heard multiple quotes from both of them throughout the episode. The first is America's Bank by Roger Lowenstein, and the second is The Panic of 1907 by Robert F. Bruner and Sean D. Carr. I tweet under the name Caleb Nygaard. Central banks affect the daily lives of all of us. Rate the podcast wherever you're listening, then share it with your coworkers, classmates, family, and friends. Until next time, thanks for listening.